Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Civil Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, March 20th, 2014, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Today, we're going to be discussing federal hate crimes. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and also this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're going to hear from two experts today with only brief introductions so we can get right to the substance. As always, the bios for both of our experts have been provided to you in the notice of this call, and they're available on the Federalist Society's website. So today we'll hear first from Professor Jennifer Mason MacWard. She is an Associate Professor of Law at Notre Dame Law School, and she will be followed by the Honorable Professor Gail Harriet. She's a professor of law at San Diego School of Law, and she's also the chairman of the Civil Rights Practice Group of the Federalist Society. And with that, Professor MacWard, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you very, very much for having me. This is Jennifer MacWard from Notre Dame Law School, and we're going to discuss today Hatch versus United States, which is a case where the cert petition is set for tomorrow's conference at the Supreme Court. And so let me provide a little bit of background on the facts and the posture of the Hatch case, and then on the law of the 13th Amendment enforcement power as it currently exists. So Hatch and his two co-defendants were found guilty in New Mexico State Court of conspiracy to commit aggravated battery. They did a bunch of horrible things, including branding a developmentally disabled Navajo man with a swastika. Hatch and his co-defendants were also charged in federal court under the Shepard-Byrd Hate Crimes Act, which, in relevant part for our purposes here, makes hate-based race crimes a federal offense. So Hatch pled guilty to the federal hate crimes charge, but he reserved his right to challenge its constitutionality under the 13th Amendment. And so the question presented in Hatch's cert petition is whether the race-based hate crimes provision of the Shepard-Byrd Act is a valid exercise of Congress's power to enforce the 13th Amendment. So turning to the 13th Amendment itself, as everybody knows, Section 1 of the 13th Amendment says, in relevant part, that neither slavery nor involuntary servitude shall exist. Section 2 of the amendment gives Congress the power to enforce that prohibition. And the enforcement language of Section 2 echoes, or actually is a precursor to the enforcement language of the two other Reconstruction Amendments, the 14th and 15th Amendments, both of which give Congress the power to enforce the relevant provisions of those amendments. So turning to the 13th Amendment, the first time that the Supreme Court really interpreted the 13th Amendment and dealt with its enforcement power was in the civil rights cases in 1883. And in that case, the court said that the 13th Amendment enforcement power allows Congress to attack not only slavery itself, but also the badges and incidents of slavery. But the court in the civil rights cases didn't define what this concept of badges and incidents of slavery might encompass. But that formulation about the enforcement power covering not only slavery but also its badges and incidents is kind of taken as 13th Amendment gospel going forward. And it wasn't until 1968 that we get the relevant governing law concerning the scope of Congress's Section 2 power under the 13th Amendment. And in Jones versus Alfred H. Mayer, the Supreme Court said that Congress has the power under Section 2 of the 13th Amendment, first, to rationally determine what are the badges and incidents of slavery, and then second, to exercise its legislative authority under Section 2 to eradicate the badges and incidents of slavery. And therefore, the Section 2 power under the 13th Amendment, the power to enforce the 13th Amendment, as interpreted by Jones, is very broad. It allows Congress, subject only to very deferential rationality review, to choose not only the means by which it will legislate, but also to define the ends toward which it will legislate, namely the badges and incidents of slavery. And that can be a very capacious concept, particularly if its definition is left to Congress, subject only to bare-bones rationality review by the Supreme Court. And so a lot of my research has focused on this 13th Amendment enforcement power, and my conclusion is that Jones-style rationality review under the 13th Amendment is problematic for two separate but somewhat interrelated reasons. First of all, on its merits, Jones expands the 13th Amendment enforcement power well beyond its original meaning. The 13th Amendment enforcement power was originally understood to be prophylactic in nature. That is, Congress could use it to legislate against actual slavery. So, for example, it could pass a law making it a crime to hold a slave. And they understood in 1865 and 1866, Congress could also use the 13th Amendment to legislate against conduct that, if it was left unchecked, could precipitate the return of slavery. Under Jones, however, Congress has relatively free rein to label lots of different things badges and incidents of slavery, and therefore Congress can ostensibly use the 13th Amendment power to legislate on topics with little, if any, real connection or threat of the return of actual slavery. So that's the concern I have with Jones on its merits. Second, Jones-style rationality review of 13th Amendment enforcement legislation, it's in considerable tension with the 1997 decision of City of Burney versus Flores. And City of Burney held that congressional enforcement legislation under the 14th Amendment requires congruence and proportionality between the constitutional injury to be prevented or remedied and the means adopted to that end. Moreover, City of Burney held that the court and not Congress gets to determine the appropriate ends of enforcement legislation. So you have the court in Burney making sure that the court itself has substantive interpretive power, and then it sets a new relatively non-deferential congruence and proportionality standard for evaluating Congress's chosen means. Both of those aspects of Burney are in serious tension with Jones, which gives Congress substantive power to define the badges and incidents of slavery, and it provides wide deference to Congress with respect to its chosen means. So were the court to grant cert in Hatch, where does that leave us? The court would have to answer two questions if it took the Hatch case. First, the court would have to determine, well, what's the appropriate standard of review for legislation passed pursuant to Section 2 of the 13th Amendment? Is it rationality review akin to Jones? Should it be turned into something more akin to City of Burney? And then second, applying whatever standard the court sets for the 13th Amendment legislation, does the Shepard-Byrd Hate Crimes Act satisfy that standard? And so what should the court do tomorrow when it's faced with the cert petition? I think that the court should grant cert. I think that Jones is not only wrong on its merits, but also in tension with another subsequent decision of the court. But to be honest, I think that it's pretty unlikely that the court is going to grant cert. So why should it grant cert? Again, Jones is wrong on the merits, and the court really just needs to clarify a consistent standard of review across the enforcement provisions of the Reconstruction Amendments. Why don't I think the court is likely to grant cert? For three reasons. First of all, there's no circuit split at this time. And it may be unlikely that a circuit split is ever going to develop because lower courts are going to feel bound by Jones. There's at least one other 13th Amendment Hate Crimes Act case that's pending, and the court may just feel like it wants to let the issue percolate for a little while longer. Second, my sense that the court's unlikely to grant cert is driven in part by last term's opinion in Shelby County versus Holder, which is the Voting Rights Act case. The court in that case had a prime opportunity to clarify the standard of review that applies to 15th Amendment enforcement legislation, and yet the court avoided that question altogether. And so if the court was inclined to ignore the question in the 15th Amendment context, it may well be inclined to avoid it in the 13th Amendment context as well. And then third, there's at least some argument to be made that the Hate Crimes Act might well satisfy the Burney congruence and proportionality standard. It's certainly not, there's no clear answer to that question. But if there's at least an argument that any Supreme Court opinion might not be outcome determinative in a Hate Crimes Act case, the court might not be inclined to take it. So that's my sense that the court should grant cert. It's unlikely to grant cert. But we are lucky today to have Professor Gail Harriott joining us on this call. Professor Harriott's participated in the oral arguments in a pending, pending Fifth Circuit case concerning the Hate Crimes Act, and she filed an amicus brief supporting the cert petition in Hatch. And so I think her perspective on this case will be really valuable. So, Professor Harriet, I just want to turn it over to you for any comments or questions you might have.
Okay, I am somewhat more optimistic than you are about the cert petition. You know, with all cert petitions, the answer is always they probably won't grant it. But I think they should grant this one, and I think there's at least a decent chance that they will. I have a somewhat different perspective on some of the aspects of this case. On one aspect of it that I thought I'd throw out, because it was one of the last things that you said, was that Shelby County makes it somewhat less likely that the court will act in this situation. I actually believe that instead Shelby County provides a different route for the court to choose to grant it. They found that the preclearance provisions of the Voting Rights Act were unconstitutional even under the rational relation test because they said, look, you have to look at current arguments and burdens on this. And they were there construing not the 1965 Act itself, but rather the amendments that were quite recent, 2006, I believe, but I could be off by a year or so there. And they were saying, look, you know, that there just was not the same level of danger of there being efforts to disfranchise African-American voters in the particular districts that were brought under the preclearance requirements in the Shelby County case. And similarly, this case, we're talking about a very recently promulgated act that is the Matthew Shepard and James Byrd Jr. Hate Crimes Prevention Act, which was passed in 2009. And if they agree with me that the ultimate aim has to be to eradicate slavery and prevent its return, then it's really hard to argue under Shelby County that this is anything other than unconstitutional. I think in some ways the two cases are very, very parallel, both dealing with very recent acts and both relying on a past issue without a record showing that there was any concern with regard to slavery or the return of slavery. So in that respect, I feel somewhat optimistic. Again, you got to remember that most cert petitions aren't granted. And so in any individual case, you bet on no. But there's a decent chance that this one will be accepted. And I think there's also an argument as to why they should want to accept it at this point rather than at some later date. Assuming that the court would indeed want to cut down somewhat on at least the ordinary wisdom about how broad the 13th Amendment is and how much power Congress has, they should be inclined to want to do that now rather than later. You know, again, they may prefer to wait for the Fifth Circuit case, but one thing about the Hate Crimes Prevention Act is that these are very emotionally charged issues, and it's better to deal with the issue now rather than wait for an emotionally charged case in the future. As you may recall, after the Zimmerman case, there were calls to prosecute Mr. Zimmerman, who had been acquitted, calls to prosecute him under the Federal Hate Crimes Act. That's not the kind of case that a court should want to address the constitutionality of the act under. Much better to do one that has received far less publicity. Much better to do it now. In addition, the 13th Amendment has become quite fashionable with a lot of academics. There's a lot of literature that Professor McAward is very familiar with, where academics have been arguing that various legislative proposals would be constitutional under Congress's 13th Amendment power. With all of this waiting around, and there's a lot of them, some people have made arguments for the regulation of payday lending under the 13th Amendment. There have been proposals for sex-specific abortions to be dealt with legislation that would be passed under the 13th Amendment. There's really quite a long list of and quite an odd kind of grab bag of legislative proposals that would, but the argument at least is that they would be justified under Congress's Section 2 power of the 13th Amendment. Rather than wait for something like that to be passed, clarifying the issue now would be very useful, and there's a decent chance they'll do it. One of the things that concerns me about the Hate Crimes Act itself is how very unrelated to actual hatred it is. Hatred is not one of the elements of the crime. It is sufficient if the defendant acted, and I'm using the statutory language here, because of somebody's, not necessarily the victim's, but anybody's race, color, national origin, sex, religion, disability, sexual orientation. Now, what's interesting about the act is that it actually comes in two parts. They do not rely upon the 13th Amendment for the whole thing. They only rely upon the 13th Amendment for the race, color, national origin provisions. Sex, sexual orientation, and disability are instead promulgated pursuant to the commerce power. So in order to prove a federal hate crime that is a matter of sex, disability, or sexual orientation, one has to prove a interstate commerce nexus. They didn't do that with the race provisions. So even if this case were taken, even if the court were to find the 13th Amendment does not support the legislation as it was promulgated, the act itself would survive, and it could be repromulgated under the commerce power. There's no argument as to the constitutionality of the commerce power parts of the statute in this case. I mean, somebody else may make the argument, but you know, it's not one that I've had anything to do with or know anything about. This is just focused on the parts of the act that are specifically related to the 13th Amendment. And I would suspect that, you know, if this did get accepted, if the case were reversed on the ground that the 13th Amendment does not provide a proper foundation here, that Congress would probably look into repromulgating in a somewhat different way. Maybe as a compromise, they might actually go so far as to include hatred as an element of the crime. I'm quite disturbed by the fact that they call it a Hate Crimes Act, and yet it doesn't require hate. A mere causal connection between these classifications and the crime itself actually brings in an awful lot that I wouldn't classify as a hate crime. I worked at the Senate Judiciary Committee for a semester back about 15 years ago, and the bill was pending even then. And we had lawyers from the Department of Justice come in and talk to us. And at the time, I was kind of concerned about the lack of a requirement of hatred. And I brought it up. I said, isn't it true that this would mean that, like, any crime involving sex in the sense of sexual conduct, not as in the sense of gender, like rape or like other crimes that involve sex in that way, wouldn't they all be crimes that occur because of the victim's gender? And I was actually expecting them to say, oh, that wouldn't be covered. But they refused to say that. They were quite happy to say that, you know, yeah, that does come under this. No, we're not going to disavow that. They like that. And that creates double jeopardy problems for a very large swath of crime. As you probably know, double jeopardy protections do not attach in a case where two different sovereignties are involved. And that's something I think that I can live with, at least, in a world where there isn't that much federal crime, where federal crime is very specific. But one of the problems I have with this act is that it covers a very large swath of crime. And together with the many other new federal criminal acts, it creates two bites at the apple for a very large number of crimes, and that I find very disturbing. And if the 13th Amendment part of the act were found to be unconstitutional, that would at least put us back in the situation where the prosecutors would have to prove an interstate commerce nexus. And if they can't do it, or if they don't want to do it, then that would cut down on the number of re-prosecutions, which I find quite disturbing.
Great.
Maybe
well,
that's
wanna...
all I'll say at this point.
Well, thank you. I think that was really helpful, and I think for our listeners it might be helpful to just kind of draw some focus on what I think are some key points that you just made. I'm sure that a lot of people would think that the 13th Amendment enforcement power is just some kind of academic exercise. But especially after City of Bernie came down in 1997, constricting the court's 14th Amendment enforcement power, you see this real rise in academic literature tapping into Jones and claiming that a whole range of conduct constitutes badges and incidents of slavery such that it can be reached by Congress under its 13th Amendment power. So everything from sexual harassment to bans on gay marriage to animal cruelty has been written about in terms of being a badge and incident of slavery. And so if Congress were to tap into that line of thinking, it could really use its 13th Amendment power in a very, very broad way. So it's not totally an academic exercise. Now, what would happen in this case if the court granted cert and took the Hatch case? First of all, I think the court would have to define what a badge and incident of slavery is. And as Professor Harriet suggested, that is kind of whatever elements you put into that definition, it would seem, particularly after Bernie, that there has to be some causal connection between the conduct that's being regulated and conduct that the court has actually said violates the 13th Amendment, which is namely limited to slavery and involuntary servitude. So I think a badge and incident of slavery has to have some kind of causal link to actual slavery and involuntary servitude. Now, in terms of the record that Congress developed with respect to the race-based provisions of the Hate Crimes Act, Congress didn't talk about a link to actual slavery. To be sure, Congress didn't think it had to. Jones is very, very broad, and Congress was legislating under that assumption. But it might be very hard for Congress to develop a record that would link race-based hate crimes to actual slavery. And then, as Professor Harriet pointed out, even if the provision were to be struck down on 13th Amendment grounds, Congress could easily kind of make that provision constitutional, or at least arguably constitutional, by adding in a commerce provision, as it has for the rest of the Act. So as she said, crimes based on sex or sexual orientation or disability require a link to interstate commerce, and so Congress could go ahead and amend the Act, the race-based provision of the Act, to include that commercial link. So anyway, I think Professor Harriet's comments are really, really important, and I just wanted to highlight those aspects of them.
Well, thank you both for those opening remarks. Let's turn to the audience. We're going to hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, you should push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We'll be taking your questions for as much as another 40 minutes or so. Before we go to the audience, let me make a brief commercial announcement here. On Monday, this is our next scheduled Teleforum conference call, Monday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. We have a Teleforum conference call looking at the Smarter Sentencing Act. This is an act presently before the Congress to reduce sentences in some case. And then on Tuesday of next week, we will be revisiting the Hobby Lobby case. We talked about it earlier this week, but it's actually going to be argued in the Supreme Court on Tuesday. So we'll have a couple of our experts in the oral argument, and they'll report what transpires there in a special courthouse steps version of a teleforum on Tuesday afternoon at a time to be scheduled. So check our website for details there. Today, of course, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We start with two callers, so let's go to our first question.
Hi, this is Ken Masugi, and Gail and I just had an exchange over lunch, and she was kind enough to send me her brief, which I urge you all to get and to read. My general question is this. Whenever especially conservatives or libertarians want to talk about the Reconstruction amendments, they really do need to address the issue of slavery and ultimately the Declaration of Independence. Because what we're talking about is a repudiation of the Dred Scott case. I mean, that has to be the purpose here. And so despite, I think the hate crime stuff goes far beyond what a badge of slavery is, but I think what we ought to pay attention to is that the term slavery itself is colorblind. I mean, that was Lincoln's whole argument throughout the Civil War, and even before, of course, that slavery is a colorblind notion, even though, you know, it was the blacks who were the slaves. But its significance in American political history is that anyone can be a slave. It wasn't simply restricted to those of African descent. And so I urge caution in the way we argue against absurd extensions of the 13th, because we don't want to sound as though we want to relitigate the Civil War.
Who wants to respond?
This is Jen McWard. I agree with that. And so there's a difference, though, between dealing with what slavery itself is, which is prohibited in the self-executing terms of Section 1 of the amendment. And so absolutely, slavery is colorblind. Anybody can be held as a slave. Anybody can be held in involuntary servitude, and those conditions shall not exist. Under Section 2 of the amendment, Congress's enforcement power, certainly Congress can pass any law that protects anybody, whatever their race, from actual slavery and involuntary servitude. And it's this additional category of badges and incidents of slavery, and trying to figure out what that means. And to that extent, I think that the Supreme Court, in using that language in 1883, did mean to, or at least arguably meant to, link that concept to kind of chattel slavery as it existed in the United States prior to the Civil War. So there might be kind of a racial connotation to badges and incidents of slavery. You can argue both sides of that. But it's important to distinguish between kind of the self-executing terms of Section 1 and the enforcement power of Section 2.
Yeah, I think...
And I think it's worth noting here that you know, what Congress has done is essentially taken the 13th Amendment and suggested that it basically is a race amendment, and it's not. It's about slavery and involuntary servitude. It's actually one of the easiest to understand of any provision in the Constitution. You know, what's it about? Well, it's about slavery and involuntary servitude. And surely Congress has some prophylactic power under that amendment in Section 2. But it has to really be prophylactic power, and not simply going off on a tangent, something that's related only to slavery in the sense that chattel slavery was practiced mainly against African Americans in this country. That's you know, a race, and now they've promulgated a rule that has something to do with race.
Yeah. Well, right. And Justice Harlan, in his Plessy dissent, made explicit reference to the 13th and the badges and incidents of slavery. So, and of course, this is when he proclaimed the colorblind Constitution, again, all in dissent. But I think it's an argument that, originalist sort of argument that ought to be taken seriously.
The thing that I find interesting is that, you know, one can look at the Jones case in 1968 and say, well, I think as a matter of statutory interpretation, the case was wrong, but I guess that's an issue for another day. But they were interpreting a Reconstruction-era statute and saying, okay, we're going to uphold this under the 13th Amendment. It's Congress has determined this as a badge and incident of slavery, and, you know, we can't say that they were irrational in doing so, so we're going to uphold this. But it's important to see that the 2009 Hate Crimes Prevention Act, with more than a century after the Reconstruction era, it's safe to say that when Congress passed the law that was being construed by the Supreme Court in the Jones case, that slavery was very fresh in their minds. It was the first, second, and third thing they were thinking about whenever they thought about any issue that had to do with race. And they were quite plausibly, when they passed that law, thinking in terms of, we need to pass this law in part to prevent the return of slavery. You know, we fought a war over it. We don't want it to come back. And this may be some aspect of it that in their minds was designed to prevent slavery's return. I don't think anybody believes that when Congress passed the Hate Crimes Prevention Act, that they were thinking that you know, our project is to prevent slavery from returning. And they didn't make that claim, and that's important. They never say at any point that they are concerned about slavery. They talk about badges and incidents, and they also talk about vestiges of slavery. As the Jones case in dicta used the word vestiges. Well, if Congress has the power to regulate the vestiges of slavery, slavery was a very important institution in the history of the country. You can probably make some causal connection between slavery and just about anything. And so, you know, that makes it different from the Jones case to say, here we're construing a statute that was passed so long after the Civil War to where it is difficult to make the argument that anyone was thinking that the project was to ensure that slavery doesn't come back.
We've got one question pending, and then our lines are open. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. Perhaps we should try to draw a finer line here, particularly in the Hatch case. It could be argued, I think, reasonably that Section 2 covers the detention, the seizure, the holding, the detention of the victim, but not the injury inflicted on him. So they could reasonably be prosecuted just for the holding, for the kidnapping, as it were, if only for a short period of time. Where the incidents and so forth of slavery are concerned, what that means from the study of history was the widespread practice during the slave South of marking slaves with ways that they could be identified if they escaped. So, for example, they could be branded, and often were, got their ears clipped, their nose clipped, manacles or slave collars put on them, and so forth. So that was the kind of sign or incident of slavery that was undoubtedly meant by the statute. The thing is now, of course, is that if the brand inflicted on the victim were something that meant, or even to have the word slave, that wouldn't be an incident of slavery or a sign of slavery because no one else would accept it as such. So even, therefore, the brand, the injury, would not be covered under that understanding. So I think if the argument is made that, yes, it does apply, but only to that part of the offense that concerns holding and not to the infliction of injury and not having anything whatsoever to do with the nature or character of the victim, but only with the fact that it's a human being that's protected under the prohibition against slavery.
Professor McAward, you wrote an article, I believe, entitled Defining the Badges and Incidents of Slavery. You want to respond?
I did. I think he makes a very interesting point about, you know, disaggregating the concept of federal criminal law pertaining to kidnapping or holding somebody temporarily and then conduct that imposes an injury. And that, again, relates to the question, well, what is a badge and incident of slavery? The Supreme Court has never defined what it is. And in Jones said that Congress gets to define it. Well, I think as a matter of separation of powers, particularly after Bernie, that has to be wrong. because Badgeson incidents are ends toward which Congress can legislate, the court needs to take an active role in defining what those ends are, namely what the badges and incidents of slavery are. My research suggests that a badge and incident of slavery has to be public or widespread private action, somewhat akin to a custom, that not only echoes an element of chattel slavery. So as the caller suggested, kind of branding of slaves was a common practice. And so in this case, branding a swastika onto the victim certainly harkens back to the practice of slavery as it existed in this country. But in addition, I think a badge and incident of slavery also has to have a causal link to the actual status of being a slave. So the conduct not only has to echo an element of slavery as it used to exist, it also has to portend the reimposition of slavery or somehow seem to cause or promise the return of slavery. And that has to be slavery as it's defined by the Supreme Court, and slavery is essentially, you know, the holding of a person in chattel slavery or involuntary servitude. And so as the caller suggests, merely branding, as horrible as it isn't enough to qualify as a badge and incident of slavery because Congress didn't make an additional finding that that conduct would bring about the return of actual chattel slavery, which seems to me an important distinction and one that the court is going to have to make if it actually grants cert in the Hatch case.
I'm actually intrigued by the argument that Congress could promulgate a general kidnapping statute pursuant to the 13th Amendment on the ground that detention is close enough to where it is, you know, actual slavery, not chattel slavery in the traditional sense in this country, but a kind of involuntary servitude. I mean, you can say if there's not a requirement of labor, that it's not really involuntary servitude, but I'm willing to go for an argument that a general kidnapping statute that results in the detention of the victim is a kind of involuntary servitude that Congress can outlaw, but that's not what they did. You know, there's nothing in the statute that requires that hate crimes be in some way related to slavery in the way that the caller was describing. For example, in the Cannon case, the one that's pending in the Fifth Circuit, that was just an ordinary street fight, bunch of drunks. What happened is that the defendants were hanging out by I believe by some sort of homeless shelter, and they decided to take a walk over to the liquor store. And I believe they were three sheets to the wind. And they happened to pass by a guy who was at a bus stop, or I believe it was a bus stop, and they asked him what time it is. And he said he didn't know what time it was, and they thought he was insolent. They thought he had a watch. He was black. They were white. And they ended up in a fight. Interestingly, the victim in that case was a much better fighter than these drunkards were and managed to get the best of all of them, even though I think there were three of them. But it was not at all a crime that's easy to relate to slavery or involuntary servitude in any sense of the word that I can come up with. It was just, you know, a street fight.
Once again, our lines are open now. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. While we're waiting to see if anybody else rings in, let me ask a question. It might have to do more with the tendencies of the Supreme Court than with this actual case. But you both seem to agree that Congress outstripped its 13th Amendment authority here, but that it would have authority under the Commerce Clause to promulgate this exact same statute or something very much like it. Is the court free, if they take this case, to reach that conclusion? That is to say, no good under 13th Amendment analysis, but under our previous Commerce Clause jurisprudence, Congress has the authority to promulgate this statute, and we're going to decide or determine that the statute's therefore valid?
Why not just say it's a tax?
Well, that's sort of where I was headed, Professor Harriet. But is that right? I mean, could the court do that, or do you want to express an opinion on that? Or?
I don't feel like I'm the world's leading authority on this issue, because I was kind of surprised with what they did in the Obamacare case. I mean, if they can take something like that where there has been an explicit statement of, you know, this is not a tax, and turn it into this is a tax, and I guess all bets are off. The trouble here is that the statute is constructed in such a way that it's very clear that interstate commerce nexus is necessary under the provisions that apply to gender, disability, and sexual orientation and such, but they don't apply to the race section. I think it would be very awkward to read that in there when it so very clearly is not part of the statute as it applies to race. I would think a more likely outcome would be they would find that part of the statute is simply unconstitutional, and the Congress would repromulgate it, requiring interstate commerce nexus. That would be the result that I would think most likely if they do find the 13th Amendment is not a proper basis for the statute. But anything can happen.
And if this case is in conference tomorrow, are we likely to hear about a cert grant when? Monday or sometime thereafter?
If there's a cert grant, you know, Monday I think is the day they would announce it. They may carry it over. That happened in the Fisher case. Fisher kept getting carried over for a couple of months, as I recall. But I suspect we'll hear Monday, and if it's a no, again, I would think Monday would be the day we'll probably find out.
Very good. Let me make a last call for questions here. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We're happy to take your questions. We've got a few more minutes.
I may follow up.
Go ahead.
I have to raise an objection at this point to the court about accepting the argument that Congress would have the authority under the Commerce Clause to make this or anything else a crime. I realize that it's so entrenched now that even people who know better are accepting it as though it was a foregone conclusion. But I just, as a constitutional scholar, I just have to demur and say, look, the Commerce Clause, together with the Necessary and the Proper Clause, do not authorize Congress to make anything a crime. Nothing whatsoever. The power to regulate is not the power to prohibit, which is not the power to impose criminal penalties, period. The only jurisdiction they would have for that would be on exclusively federal territory, like the District of Columbia, not on state territory.
I'm happy to abstain on all issues of commerce power. Not my area. Congress obviously thinks they can do this. No one has challenged them on that.
They challenge them all the time. They just don't listen.
No, challenged in a lawsuit. Nobody's brought that argument up in connection with the Matthew Shepard and James Byrd Hate Crimes Prevention Act.
Well, Professor, we don't have any questions, any further questions pending. Let me give each of you a chance to offer a final thought if you'd like to. And let's go in the order we began in. Professor McAward, a final thought?
Oh, sure. I just want to say thanks for inviting me to participate in this. I think that Hatch is a really interesting case, in large part because it intersects with my research interests. But I think that it would be a mistake to view it as a narrow 13th Amendment question. I think it really intersects in an important way with Bernie and even Shelby County, and it gives the court an opportunity to think in a holistic and uniform way about the powers of Congress to enforce the Reconstruction Amendments and to come up with a consistent standard of review. So even though I'm not all that optimistic that the court will grant cert in Hatch, it would certainly be a welcome development.
Professor Harriet?
Well, I'll be Mary Sunshine here. Again, I don't think they will likely grant cert, but I think we got a decent shot at this. In fact, I completely agree with Professor McAward that, you know, this has been a long process, you know, of redefining exactly what congressional power is under the Reconstruction Amendments. And they have now dealt with the 14th Amendment with City of Bernie. And the 15th Amendment they didn't change the standard, but what they did do is make very clear that the rational relations standard has teeth. And, you know, that's enough in this case if they simply say, look, the standard we announced in Jones was right, but it's not what you think. It's not as easy to qualify as some people have assumed. They've assumed that basically Congress gets to do whatever it wants. Well, it didn't get to do whatever it wanted in the Shelby County case, and I don't think that if the court takes it, I believe that if the court takes it, and I think we have a decent shot, that they will be clear that this is an overreach as well.
Well, let me thank you both, Professor MacWard and Professor Harriet. We certainly appreciate you sharing your thoughts here with us today. To the audience, a reminder that our next scheduled Teleforum conference call is Monday at 2 p.m. When speaking of Congress's commerce power and ability to criminalize acts, we'll be talking about the Smarter Sentencing Act with a couple experts. That's Monday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. But until then, we're adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.